Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A woman gets pregnant. She's 9 months. She walks across the border. She has the baby in the United States. And we take care of the baby for 85 years. I don't think so. And by the way, Mexico and almost every other country anywhere in the world doesn't have that. We're the only ones dumb enough, stupid enough to have it. And people, and by the way, this is not just with respect to Mexico. They're coming from Asia to have babies here, and all of a sudden we have to take care of the babies for the life of the baby. A woman gets pregnant.
Good morning. It is March the 24th, and this is The True Conservative. Welcome to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. I'm Ron, your host, and the only true conservative in the United States today. So today, after the Serenity Prayer and the Star-Spangled Banner, we will have Race, Shame on Tucker Carlson, Don't Be Fooled, Gas Stoves, Don't Overreact, Teachers Strike, Tucker Carlson, No Free Lunch, George Lakoff, Covert Manipulation, and The Rape of the Mind. All that and more when I get back. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing and remove your hats for the national anthem of the United States of America.
Thank you. And now there's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths by David Bahnsen.
It has never been the argument of most of those who favor markets that economic freedom and free exchange are somehow sufficient to reduce poverty. These things are certainly indispensable, witness the failure of planned economies to solve the problem of scarcity, but they're not enough. Among other things, stable governments that provide infrastructure, property arrangements that identify clearly who owns what, and above all, the rule of law, are just as essential. The lack of rule of law not only ranks among the biggest obstacles to their ability of developing nations to generate wealth on a sustainable basis, but also hampers their capacity to address economic issues in a just manner. Market-oriented scholars have been underscoring for several decades the vital importance of values and institutions in explaining the causes of economic growth and decline. Dr. Samuel Gregg, the great straw man advocates of a free and virtuous society must avoid walking into is the accusation that we believe society can be organized optimally by pure laissez-faire with no regard for the peripheral components necessary to optimize freedom and flourishing. While the socialist embraces top-down social organization and the radical individualist may advocate a stateless social cooperative, our vision for society must be rooted in the rule of law, defense of property rights, and equally important, the values and virtues that will either see market economies flourish or else languish.
And that was There's No Free Lunch by David Bahnsen. Back in a minute. Thank you. A little bit of Tucker Carlson.
Welcome back to our lying special. There are a couple purposes of lying. The most obvious is to hide what you're actually doing. But the more sinister intent of lying is to cause people to be terrified and to hate each other. And you see an awful lot of that. Here's one example. The Florida NAACP just declared that it is unsafe for black people to visit the state of Florida. Watch this.
So, he plays a clip where an NAACP person claims that there's laws in Florida that are anti-black or whatever. But what's going on here is getting all black people together. And as I've said, that for black people in this country, their number one job is to be black. To be black, blacker, blackest. And it is the NAACP, among others, that decides what is or isn't black. And so apparently it's no longer black to travel to Florida. But this is the way that the mentality is shaping up. This is why you have black people that are not seen in certain segments of our society. Why aren't there more black doctors? Why aren't there more black surgeons? Why aren't there more black sports team owners? Simple. Because the NAACP says that it's not black to own a baseball team. It's not black to do all the other things where they decide what it is that's black and what isn't. What is bougie or Uncle Tom, etc. Back in a minute. Thank you. And now, the next three covert emotional manipulation tactics.
21. Brandishing anger, or traumatic one-trial learning. The manipulator will put on an act of intense anger for the purpose of shocking you into submission. This is called traumatic one-trial learning, because it will quickly train you to avoid confronting, upsetting, or contradicting the manipulator. 22. Scapegoating. A scapegoat is defined as a person or animal that takes on the sins of others. They are unfairly blamed for other people's problems. A scapegoat is also known as a whipping boy or a fall guy. Scapegoating is a process of singling out a victim and making them responsible for problems when they are not really the one who deserves the blame. A person can be made into a scapegoat for a relationship or for an entire family or even a workplace. Skilled manipulators usually scapegoat another person on purpose, while others unconsciously project their unwanted thoughts and feelings onto another to make them take the blame for their own mistakes or shortcomings, which relieves the one doing the scapegoating of shame, blame, and responsibility. Many of the manipulation tactics listed here include an element of victim blaming. But scapegoating goes beyond that. People who are made into scapegoats feel deep and persistent shame and develop a victim mentality. 23. Belittling. The manipulator will diminish and belittle the victim's opinions and ideas, either verbally or non-verbally, through the use of eye rolls, scoffs, smug smiles, sarcasm, or a mocking tone of voice. This tactic induces shame and humiliation, crushes your self-esteem, and makes you much less willing to voice your opinions and ideas in the future. Diminishing a victim's self-esteem makes it easy for a manipulator to put himself in control. 24. Putting you on the defensive. Many of the covert tactics listed here will put you on the defensive, meaning that they cause you to feel you must verbally defend who you are, what you believe, or what the truth is. It's an important sign to look for if you're trying to determine if you're a victim of manipulation. There is a reason manipulators want to put you on the defense. Covert manipulation tactics trigger you to react emotionally instead of responding rationally, which is exactly what the manipulator wants. Calm, rational conversations don't always go in their favor. In addition, they can use your emotional reactions against you if they choose to, as you've seen in several other tactics.
And that was the next, actually four, covert emotional manipulation tactics. And it should remind you of the way Democrats treat Republicans and conservatives. Think about it. Back in a minute. Thank you. Thank you. A little bit of Stuart Varney. And some comments.
Really the result of a landmark Supreme Court decision which held the prosecution must hand over potentially favorable evidence to the defense. Somebody going for a federal judgeship needs to know that.
Is the administration playing identity politics with that
110%.
Then that's the problem.
That is a huge problem.
Thank you.
So that was, they're talking about a nominee for a judgeship, I'm guessing it's the appeals court, by the current administration, and it's a black man that, and he was asked a simple question, how would you decide the Brady decision, and he couldn't answer it. So what they're then, these analysts are saying, Stuart and his guest, is that this man was selected for his skin color, not for his knowledge or abilities. So then the reason, a lot of times people are asking the question, why aren't there more blacks in wherever, whether it's judgeships, why aren't there more blacks in owning baseball teams or whatever? And so then a lot of white people will choke on that, and they will, and they assume, well, it's got to be racism. So people like Joe Biden then say, well, we have to just rush out and start loading up positions with black people. Just grab any black person, the first black person that you see, and put them into that position. The problem is not that it is white people that are keeping blacks from having these positions. For instance, it is what it is the so-called leaders of the so-called black community that are holding them back. The leaders of the black community are the ones that decide what is black. Okay, they first are the ones that decide that if you're a black person in the United States of America today, that's your number one job. Your number one job is to be black, black, blacker, blackest. And that they will tell you what it means to be black. They will tell you, in essence, what jobs it's okay to go out and get and what jobs it's not okay to go out and get. Perfectly acceptable to play sports, but it's not acceptable to own a sports team. Perfectly okay to be an actor or actress, but not okay to own your own network. That kind of thing. So that's the reason. If the black community will go ahead and decide that it wants to expand what it means to be black to include judgeships, to include being able to, because being a judge means that you've got to go to Harvard. It's not black to go to Harvard, apparently, because not very many people, black people, do it. I think former President Obama is a notable exception. But when you get to the point either that the black, so-called black community throws off these leaders and says, we're tired of your Marxist ways, we're looking for personal prosperity, and we want to be able to do whatever it is that we want or need to do. We want, number one, first of all, independence, not to be told what to do by you and the likes of you. When that happens, then and only then are you going to see positions in this country that were formerly dominated by white people begin to be populated with non-whites. And the same thing goes for Hispanics. Number one job for Hispanics is to be Hispanic. It's to be la raza. And it is the so-called leaders in the Hispanic community that decide what it means to be Hispanic, to be Mexican, El Salvadoran, whatever, and that you have to do what they say. And if there's anything, again, if it means owning a baseball team is not considered Mexican, is not part of La Raza, you can't do it, because your first duty, your first job is to be Hispanic, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, that's the problem. If we want more blacks and non-whites in our society, in positions of responsibility, it is going to have to be those communities that open up and redefine what it means to be black or Hispanic. Back in a minute. Thank you. And now a little bit more of Tucker Carlson.
Carve out for a new program called Addressing the Maternal Health Crisis. Now, on its face, addressing the maternal health crisis sounds unobjectionable. But if you drill down into the details, some of that money, and it's not clear how much of it, will be used for implicit bias trading, which I know is something that you've covered on your show before.
So, for the babies or for the mothers? Do the babies get called racist or the moms?
I think it's for doctors and other medical professionals, and it's part of a trend we're seeing in medical schools, nursing programs, and continuing education programs, where implicit bias training holds that all white people, by nature of just being born, harbor prejudices and bigotries against minorities. Now,
So I want to stop there, because, again, the whole thing of it is the key word there is white people. Who's white? Who's white? Am I white? Are you white? Is the person across the street white? Who's white? See, what they're counting on in order to make this work is self-identification. That you're going to fill out a form somewhere, maybe you're a doctor, and because he was saying it's probably going to be doctors that are going to be part of this program. Basically, what they're talking about, by the way, is a part of the budget. That $7 trillion budget, that omnibus budget bill that got signed recently, as a matter of fact, it was last year, in part of it is for, when you look deep into it, you can find all this money that's going to be spent on this kind of training. Now, the doctors that are going to be trained, how are they going to determine who's white and who isn't? Are they going to walk around to all these doctors and go, you look white, you need to meet at 1 o'clock this afternoon in the conference room for sensitivity training? No, they're not going to do that. What they're going to do is they're going to go through the records. They're going to go through everybody's files, and in everybody's files, there's a form, and it's usually done for statistical purposes. We've all had to fill it out, and it asks you, what is your sex, okay? And then it asks you, what is your race? Now, also, in both of those sections, there is a place, one of the boxes you can check that says, I refuse to state. I dare say most people don't do that. especially if you consider yourself a minority. If you consider yourself to be black or Hispanic or something like that, you figure maybe that's going to be as powerful down the line if you go ahead and identify yourself. But anyways, the point is, I dare say, and I've done it myself in the past, but I'm out of the habit of doing that anymore because that's the way they're going to identify you. If you get called into a conference where you're going to have to be attending one of these conferences, and the guest that Tucker Carlson has on went on to say that these are humiliating, and I think that's the purpose of it, to humiliate people. So you end up becoming humiliated because you're forced to admit that you're basically a racist. So how do you avoid it? Well, you can go ahead and take the class anyways and resist or defy or whatever, but that's not that's putting your job at risk and creating unknown consequences. You don't know what the consequences are going to be down the line for resisting or just refusing to show up even. You say, you know, you tell the people, you know, I'm not going to show up for this. I don't have to, and that's that. But what's going to happen? Are you going to get fired? Are you going to get demoted? Are you going to get, and if so, will you have a legal case? Will you be able to receive compensation for damages that you receive as a result of this? You don't know. And nobody wants to go into the unknown, right? So one of the best ways to handle this is to go into human resources, tell them that you want to see that the form you filled out where you identify, check it, and if you have gone ahead and identified yourself in a certain way, then you need to change it to refuse to state. On both of them, sign it and date it. Refuse to state. So you could also maybe even do a letter and take it to human resources, say, I want this put in my record, and write a letter saying any indications in my records that indicate what my race or my sex is incorrect, nobody's business, or whatever, and the real answer is I refuse to state, something to that effect. But the point is, and every time that you're given the opportunity, anywhere you go, to refuse to state, and even if you aren't, you need to seriously consider refusing to answer those questions. Because remember, on that piece of paper, it also says that it's just for statistical purposes. And basically what it's for actually is for tax cuts. So if you hire X amount of minorities, you might get certain tax breaks you otherwise wouldn't. If you've hired, one of the other questions they ask is, are you a veteran? Are you disabled? And because, again, there's tax breaks that are potentially involved in that as well. So, but anyways, the point is, do not, for the foreseeable future, answer those questions, because that's how they're going to identify who goes to these humiliating classes and who doesn't. Is they're going to go through everybody's records, look at what you put down, and all the people that marked white / Caucasian are going to end up in the humiliation classes, are going to end up being subjected to sadistic activities. So that's the best way, the easiest way that I can see to avoid this and avoid all the problems associated with it is to put refuse to state. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. And now, The Rape of the Mind by Joost Mierlo.
The therapist as an instrument of coercion. Medical therapy and psychotherapy are the subtle sciences of human guidance in periods of physical and emotional stress. Just as training requires the alert, well-planned participation of both student and teacher, so successful psychotherapy requires the alert, well-planned participation of both patient and doctor. And just as educational training under special conditions can degenerate into coercive taming, so therapy can degenerate into the imposition of the doctor's will on his patient. The doctor himself need not even be conscious that this is happening. This misuse of therapy may show itself in the patient's submission to the doctor's point of view or in the patient's development of excessive dependency on his therapist. Such a dependency, and even increased dependency need, may extend not only far beyond the usual limits, but may continue even after the therapy has run its course. I've seen quacks whose only knowledge was where to buy their couches. By calling themselves psychoanalysts, they were able to gratify their own need to live other people's lives. Eventually, the law will have to establish standards which can keep these dangerous intruders from psychotherapeutic practice. But even the honest, conscientious therapist has serious moral problems to face. His profession itself continually encourages him, indeed obliges him, to make his patients temporarily dependent on him. And this may appeal to his own need for a sense of importance and power. He must be continually aware of the impact his statements and deductions have on his patients, who often listen in awe to the doctor who is, for them, the omniscient magician. The therapist must not encourage this submissive attitude in his patients, though in some phases of the treatment it will help the therapy. For good psychotherapy aims toward educating man for freedom and maturity, not for conforming submission. The practitioners of psychology and psychiatry are now much more aware of the responsibility their profession imposes on them than they have ever been heretofore. The tools of psychology are dangerous in the hands of the wrong men. Modern educational methods can be applied in therapy to streamline man's brain and change his opinions so that his thinking conforms with certain ideological systems. Medicine and psychiatry may become more and more involved in political strategy, as we have seen in the strategy of brainwashing. For this reason, psychologists and psychiatrists must become more aware of the nature of scientific tools they use. The emphasis on therapeutic techniques, on students knowing all the facts and the tricks, the overemphasis on psychotherapeutic diplomas and labels lead actual therapy toward conformism and rationalization of principles that are in contrast to the personal sensitivity needed. Our critical and rational faculty can be a destructive one, destroying or disguising our basic doubts and ambivalences born out of tragic despair, that creator of human sensitivity. The danger of modern psychotherapy and psychology is the tendency toward formalizing human intuition and empathy, and toward making an abstraction of emotion and spontaneity. It is a contradiction to attempt to mechanize love and beauty. If this were possible, we would find ourselves in a world where there is no inspiration and ecstasy, but only cold understanding. Every human relationship can be used for the wrong or the right aims. And this is especially true of the relationship of subtle unconscious ties which exist between psychotherapist and patient. This statement is equally true for medicine in general. The surgeon, too, thrives on strong ties with his patients and their willing submission to his surgical techniques. Freud gave us the first clear explanation of what happens in the mind during prolonged mental contact with a human being. He showed that in every intensive human relationship, each participant reacts, at least partially, in terms of the expectations and illusions he developed in his own childhood. As a result, prolonged therapy, based on the principle of utter freedom of expression, provides as much opportunity for transference of private feelings for the doctor as for the patient. The doctor is not careful, or if he does not understand this mutual transfer of hidden emotions, or if, in his compulsive zest to explain everything, he is too coercive, he may force the patient into acceptance of his point of view instead of helping the patient arrive at his own. This can become mental intrusion of a dangerous kind. Experiences in therapy have taught us that faulty technique can give the patient feelings of being bogged down. Sometimes patients feel as if they have to remain living in a servile submission to the doctor. I have seen whole families and sects swear by modern witch doctors. No wonder that sound psychoanalytic instruction requires the therapist to submit himself for years to the technique he is about to apply to others, so that, armed with the knowledge of his own unsound, unconscious needs, he will not try to use his profession to mastermind other people's lives. Various psychological agencies with their different psychological concepts and techniques, such as family counseling, religious guidance, management counseling, and so forth, can easily be misused as tools of power. The goodwill that people invest in their leaders, doctors, and administrators is tremendous and can be used as a weapon against them. Even modern brain surgery for healing the mind could be misused by modern dictators to make zombies out of their competitors. Psychology itself may tend to standardize the mind, and the tendency among different schools of psychology to emphasize orthodoxy increases unwittingly the chances for mental coercion. If you don't talk my magic gobbledygook, I have to condition you to it. It is easier to manipulate the minds of others than to avoid doing so. A democratic society gives its citizens the right to act as free agents. At the same time, it imposes on them the responsibility for maintaining their freedom, mental as well as political. If, through the use of modern medical, chemical, and mechanical techniques of mental intrusion, we reduce man's capacity to act on his own initiative, we subvert our own beliefs and weaken our democratic system. Just as there is a deliberate political brainwashing, so can there be a suggestive intrusion masquerading under the name of justice or therapy. This may be less obtrusive than the deliberate totalitarian attack, but it is no less dangerous. Medication into submission is an existing fact. Man can use his knowledge of the mind of a fellow being not to help him, but to hurt him and bog him down. The magician can increase his power by increasing the anxieties and fears of his victim, by exploiting his dependency needs, and by provoking his feelings of guilt and inferiority. Drugs and medical techniques can be used to make man a submissive and conforming being. This we have to keep in mind in order to be able to make him really healthy and free. Chapter 4. Why did they...
And that was The Rape of the Mind, Chapter 3. And let's see what we got here. The Therapist as an Instrument of Coercion. Back in a minute. Thank you. And now, Don't Think of an Elephant by Dr. George.
The press, quoting the attacks, used the term Obamacare and not the clunky name Affordable Care Act. Obama eventually tried in vain to turn this to his advantage, saying it meant Obama Cares. But it was too late. The conservatives had given the name the meaning they wanted by frequent enough repetition. The president and members of the administration counterattacked with lists of facts. The provisions of the plan. It didn't help. The president went on TV with a laundry list of provisions. It didn't help. His advisor, David Axelrod, sent a memo to Organizing for America's email list, roughly 13 million supporters strong, asking them to speak to their friends and neighbors in support of the president's plans. He said there were 24 things to remember, but just to make it easier, he divided the list of facts into three groups of eight. Any cognitive scientist could have told him no one was going to remember the three groups of eight, and I have never met anyone who has. Conservatives won the framing war of 2009, and it helped strengthen the nascent Tea Party movement, as Tea Partiers were deployed to go to town meetings around the country that summer and repeat government takeover, death panels, and Obamacare. If the president had understood the conservative framing tactic, he could have undercut it in a simple way. He could have adopted the same two moral issues, freedom and life, from a progressive perspective. If you have cancer and you don't have health care, you are not free. You are probably going to suffer and die, a life issue. If you are in a car accident and suffer multiple injuries and don't have health care, you are not free. You may be disabled for life or die. Even if you break your leg and do not have access to health care and cannot get it set, you are not free. You may never walk or run freely again. Ill health enslaves you. Disease enslaves you. Even cataracts that rob your vision and can easily be healed by modern medicine will enslave you to blindness without health care. Healthy food is also a freedom issue. Much of big agriculture produces unhealthy food, especially processed food, sugary food, food with unhealthy additives, meats with hormones and antibiotics from animals raised on pesticide-treated feed, and so on. Access to healthy food is a freedom issue. And when conservatively run states turn down funds for Medicaid, that is a freedom issue, both for the people who are being denied health care and for everyone else to whom a curable disease can spread when health care is denied to a significant number of the people they interact with every day. Freedom issues are powerful issues. Education. Conservatives want to eliminate public resources as a moral issue. In their view, they are given for free and therefore take away personal responsibility and the incentive to work. Education is a main example. In conservatively run states like Wisconsin, funding for public education has been severely cut. The conservative movement against public school education offers the alternative of charter schools, religious schools, and private schools. Charter schools are schools paid for publicly but run privately, very often by for-profit corporations. The Credo study at Stanford in 2013 found that about 75% of charter schools have results that are worse than or no different from traditional public schools. A small percentage of charter schools do have better results. But since funds for charter schools are taken from public school budgets, charter schools tend to drain money from public schools and make public education worse on the whole, even for the best public schools. Moreover, charter schools have no accountability to local school districts or the public. A consequence in Texas, for example, is that charter schools tend to debunk evolution and science and teach creationism. In Michigan, 80% of schools are now charter schools, and they are doing no better at educating children in poverty than public schools. The conservative framing is that public schools are failing, and that vouchers for religious or private schools give parents choice. Those vouchers tend not to pay for high-quality schools, so that poor families that receive them tend not to get high-quality education for their children. But for wealthy parents, the vouchers represent public support for the wealthy and a cut in support for those who lack wealth. The conservative attack on public education is being felt drastically in higher education. Conservatives in state legislatures are cutting funding for higher education with two horrendous consequences. State-run colleges and universities used to be the gateways to education for poor and lower-middle-class students. As conservatives cut state university budgets, the schools, to stay in business, have had to raise their tuition, pricing higher education out of reach for a great many of these students. Students' only alternative has been to borrow money, which raises the second problem, student debt. At a time when banks can borrow money at 1% interest, students have to pay 8% interest on their loans, which burdens them with many years of loan payments after they graduate. That makes it harder for them to afford getting a postgraduate education or starting a family. Present calculations are that if the government forgave all student loans, it would boost the nation's economy far more than the cost of the loans. Nevertheless, conservatives are against both loan forgiveness and dropping the interest on student loans to the same rate that banks pay. Whether at the level of preschool, K through 12, or higher education, the conservative move is to reduce or end public education, as part of the move to end public resources in general. Education is a freedom issue, but that is not now being said in public discourse. Without education, you are not free in many, many ways. Education tells you about the world and the possibilities in life. If you don't know what is possible, you cannot even set goals. Education isn't just about filling your head with facts. It's about teaching you to think, to notice, to be critical, to act rationally, to be practical, and to get access to facts for yourself. Education gives you skills, the ability to do things you couldn't do otherwise. Yes, educated people have more economic potential, and money can make you free in many ways, but the freedom education offers goes well beyond money. It opens the possibilities for connections to the natural world, for an aesthetic life, for a life of ideas, for an understanding of what is going on around you, and for an understanding of yourself. And it gives you the knowledge and the opportunity to be a productive citizen, to contribute to your own freedom and the freedom of others via political and social engagement. If education in general is a freedom issue, public education on the whole is an even more powerful freedom issue, with two important components. Public education is publicly accessible. It gives educational access to more people and so increases their freedoms. It also allows individuals to understand the full range of people, and therefore opens up human relationships and the possibility of empathizing with and understanding more people. Public education is publicly accountable education. It prevents the narrowing of what is taught when private interests determine what is taught. Moreover, systemic causation further makes education a freedom issue because many of our major educational issues are due to poverty. Poverty all too often means that parents who have to hold down multiple jobs cannot properly raise their children. Not reading to them, not raising them to respect education, not being able to get them out of unhealthy environments. Poverty means children going to school hungry in the morning and not able to concentrate on classes. And poverty and lack of education replicate themselves. In a large range of cases, the failure of students to learn has mainly to do with a national economic failure and not with inadequate teachers or schools. Poverty.
And that was Don't Think of an Elephant by Dr. George Lakoff. It's actually George Lakoff, Ph.D. One of the things that when you're listening to this, this is going to be very, very intimidating, right? Because he's talking about how basically that trying to make the case or actually intimidate people into believing that conservatives are somehow against freedom. And what he's doing, though, is using freedom as a metaphor. He's using it in a metaphorical way because education has got nothing to do with freedom. Whether you have an education or you don't have an education, as an American citizen, you're still free. And all of the other things that he was listing that were based there about freedom, the freedom, oh, health care, that was the other big deal. If you don't have health care, you're still a free person. Because you're free to either get health care or not get health care. There's plenty of people that decide they don't want to pay for insurance for whatever reason. And they're free to do so, literally. But he is, again, using the word freedom metaphorically and therefore as a weapon. And it works because conservatives use the word freedom a lot. Conservatives are always concerned about freedom and the encroachment of government at all levels and how the encroachment of that government restricts individual liberties and freedoms. So by using this freedom as a weapon against conservatives, it's very, I suppose, ironic and can be very effective in putting people in a position of feeling intimidated. But once you know that what he's doing is using the word as a metaphor, it loses all of its power. Think about it. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. A little bit of Tucker Carlson and a quick comment. Let's do this and this.
Right. It is a measure of a lot of things, apparently, according to the research. So for nearly 80 years, the collective IQ in the United States increased every decade, and nutrition was always one of the reasons people thought that was true. But it's no longer true. In fact, the opposite is true, and all of your suspicions are now confirmed. Americans are getting dumber, and not just Sandy Cortez. She gets elected for a reason. So researchers at Northwestern University recently found that American IQs are dropping. And they had...
Shame on Tucker Carlson here. He says researchers found... How did they find? doesn't say, no answer, that American IQs are dropping. Well, how did they figure that out? No answer. This is irresponsibility on the part of Tucker Carlson. So shame on Tucker Carlson for this kind of, I don't even want to call it reporting because it's not even that, for this kind of garbage. He is better than that, and he can do better than that. Back in a minute. Thank you very much. This is the Eyewitness News at 5 p.m. covering the strike. Here, let's do this and that.
Pretty substantial, according to the superintendent. I haven't done the math, but they're going to get a 6% wage increase retroactive to July 1st, 2021. They're going to get a 7% wage increase retroactive to July 1st, 2022, plus a $1,000 bonus. And on top of that, they're getting another raise of 7% starting July 1st of this year. So those retroactive checks, are going to get those pretty much immediately. And as superintendent said, it's a check that they're going to remember because it's going to be a pretty large amount.
That's always great to hear. We just heard Max Arias, who's the executive director of SEIU Local 99, talking about this is going to make such a big impact on these people, on their families, because so many of these members, they have worked 2 to 3 jobs. They don't get to come home at night to see their families. So hopefully this will give them enough money to maybe focus on their family, their personal lives, be able to spend in their communities, be able to have a little bit more breathing room and achieve the American dream and get them out of poverty.
Both sides.
So anyways, so the union wins. I want that noted for the record that in this particular battle between the LAUSD and the union won. Now, actually, this should have been a, in terms of negotiations, there should have been 3 parties at the table. Management, which I guess is represented by the superintendent, the workers, and then the customers, because that's who got screwed in this deal. Actually, the superintendent made out okay, I'm sure. Maybe he didn't get a raise out of this or whatever, but his money wasn't touched, so he's okay. Who is it that's going to end up paying for these increases? The customers. We are going to pay for it. We're going to have to pay for it in either interest if they decide to use bonds to pay for this, or increases in taxes to pay for this. But it is, we're the ones that are going to have to pay for this. And as usual in any type of a labor dispute, the customer is out of the equation. Nobody talks about or represents the customer here. So it is the teachers win, the teachers union successfully bullied the superintendent into giving them what they want at the parents and children's expense. When you hear these the teachers and the other union members talking about it's, you know, how much they care about the kids, they're liars. Unions are about solidarity. That's the number one rule of any union, is solidarity. And the children are not in their union. Okay, neither are the parents. So again, who are the winners? The union members, the public employee union members. And the big losers are the parents and the children. How do we stop this? Decertify all public employee unions immediately. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. So some Stuart Varney here that I want to play for you. Let's do that.
Liberals wanted to keep government out of the boardroom and bedroom and kitchen.
Yes.
And now they want to regulate. And it's not just that. Flush toilets, washers and dryers, dishwashers, and they don't clean your dishes. So, you know, they say these things are going to save water. I love this. But you actually have to run the cycle twice.
Yeah.
So, you know, to flush the toilet twice or run the... I mean, these things are insane. People want utilities and things in their home that work. And by the way, they would take our gas stove out of our kitchen, out of my dead wife's cold hands. She is...
And that was again Stuart Varney with one of his guests. And it was, what does it say here? Energy Secretary downplays impact of gas stove rules. And so if you really want to attack this, because then he goes on, you know, to complain about, you know, how basically how ineffective the rule is going to be. And that's not the issue. If you really want to get to these people, because they really think they're slick, and I'm talking about the Energy Secretary now. The Energy Secretary thinks she's slick because she has a philosophical theory underpinning what it is that she's doing, because the administration isn't getting the permission of the people of the United States. They didn't run a poll or a survey that says that they discovered that of those surveyed, 60 or 70% want to give up their gas stoves for electric. Okay? No. What they're doing is they're trying to force something on us. So how do you justify that in a democracy? You don't, first of all. They don't look at this as a democracy. This is basically a socialist dictatorship in the making. But their theory, their underlying theory, is deterministic. They claim or think that we're operating under false consciousness, that we have been brainwashed by the people that make gas stoves and the gas company to use products that we really don't want. And so it is up to the government to rescue us from our false consciousness. Okay, and they're going to do this by forcing products onto us because they claim we really want all electric instead of gas, but we just don't know it because we've been brainwashed by big gas, I guess is the way to put it. So if you're going to object to it, that's the basis on which to object to it. Say, false consciousness is BS. We know what we want. We want gas stoves. We like gas stoves. And that's all there is to it. The same thing happens with automobiles. The governments, large and small, want to interfere with our ability to get around in an automobile because they claim false consciousness, that we really don't want to drive in cars. We really don't want it. You know, we'd really rather take the bus. We'd really rather drive a bicycle. We'd really rather walk to places, which is ridiculous. If they came out and made that kind of an argument, they'd get laughed off the planet. Okay? So that's why they're always keeping it in the background. It's subterranean, and they're stealthy about the situation. They just do what it is that they think they have to do, and they don't bother with explanations or debates, which is, by the way, undemocratic. So anyways, they, as far as the cars are concerned, they claim that there is a car culture, and the car culture brainwashes the average individual into wanting to buy and drive automobiles, even though we really don't want them. We're brainwashed into doing it anyways, and so does the gas companies and the oil companies. They all conspire to brainwash us into buying things we really don't want or need. That's determinism. We do everything because we're forced to. So they see that the government is the rescuer. They're going to come to our rescue, and they're going to reforce us to do what it is they pretend or think that we really want to do, which is to walk, take public transportation, or ride a bicycle. Back in a minute. Thank you, thank you. Something that's been on my mind the past couple of days, but I keep forgetting to talk about it, is there was a bill that was put in front of President Biden the other day that he vetoed, that the Republicans came up with. And they came up with this bill, and it had to do with ESG and people's retirements. And the Biden administration wants more ESG, whatever the hell that is. I don't know, and I don't care. But it's supposed to be in more people's retirement portfolios. And so the Republicans came along, and they wrote some kind of a bill that basically either overturned it. It may have been that the Biden administration did an executive order on this. And so the Republicans went ahead and wrote a bill and to say, no, that's not necessary to countermand what it is that Biden did. Well, of course, and it passed both the houses, and then Biden vetoed it. Right. And so then there's going to be those people that are going to pat the Republicans on the back. Way to go. You know, you gave it your best shot. But this is, again, this is more politicking by Republicans to tell people in the United States, particularly Republicans, to give more money. Give more money to the party. Go out and campaign for us so that we can take the Senate and take the White House, and then we'll be able to pass this kind of a bill. But it's crap. They could pass this bill now, if not right this moment, but they could pass the bill before getting control of the Senate, before getting control of the White House. And the way they do it is the same way the Democrats do it. The Democrats, what they will do is they use it as what's called in politics a poison pill. They'll slip it into another bill. Okay, because in the House of Representatives, you don't have to have a germaneness. There's no germaneness issues. In the Senate, they have these rules about germaneness. If you're going to create a bill, or if you're actually going to add something to a bill, an amendment, then it has to be germane to the bill, but not in the House of Representatives. So you can put all kinds of things in bills. The point is Democrats regularly slip things into bills that have nothing to do with the original bill. They'd love to do it with budgets. And they'll slip something into the budget or slip something into some other type of what they call an omnibus bill and slip that in there. And then what it does is it puts the president on the spot. The president wants to sign the overall bill, but he doesn't want this poison pill in there. So now he's in a dilemma. Do I veto the bill, even though most of it is what I want, to get rid of the part I don't like, or do I go ahead and sign the bill to keep what I want, but I end up also keeping the part I don't like? The Republicans could play that game too. Slip this piece of legislation into something else. Slip it into a budget. Slip it into some other type of an omnibus type bill, and put it in there as an amendment, and put the president on the spot. Make him choose. Make his decision difficult. They didn't do that. They made it easy for the president. It was a standalone bill, and they said, here. Here, Mr. President, please go ahead and veto this, because they knew he was going to veto it. They knew it. So they weren't very clever about it, and they could have been, and they still can be. So my point here, and the reason I'm telling everybody this, is don't be impressed. Don't be impressed with what the Republicans did. It was a failure, and I believe it was a deliberate failure on the Republicans' part. This is just a way of saying, you know, eyewash for the American public. And they can stand up and say, well, we did this, we did that. No, you didn't. You failed. That's what you did. And you didn't even make a good effort. Okay, it's like we still don't have the defunding of Planned Parenthood. We still don't have an alternative to Obamacare. We still don't have that alternative. The Republican Party has been jumping up and down, screaming and yelling about Obamacare for years, but they've done nothing about it. And they could. And they should. So, but again, don't be impressed with the Republicans and what they did with this ESG bill. It was a failure. It was a deliberate failure on their part. It was just simply eyewash. And if you get the opportunity, maybe on the radio, if you call into a radio station, if there's a Republican on there and you get the opportunity to confront some of these office holders about this, feel free to do so. Or do it in social media, Twitter and whatnot, and let them know, you didn't fool me on this one. You could have slipped it into something else. You didn't do it. You didn't make a good effort. And let them know you're not fooled. Back in a minute. So thank you. I was thinking about a few things while I was waiting for there's having a press conference right now at LAUSD because the teachers went out on strike. And again, this is what happens when you allow public employees to unionize. Then you get the spectacle of a strike where they're going to basically threaten our children so they can make more money. And then have the guts to say, oh, but I love my job. Sure, whatever. Anyway, so we're waiting for that. Apparently it's over, and so they're having some kind of a press conference about it. And while I'm waiting for that to be over, I was thinking about some of this queer theory and some of the other things that seem like, because there's a lot of people that are talking still, talk show hosts that are talking about, oh, the country's going to hell in a handbasket, or it's revolution or civil war or whatever, the country's being ruined or whatnot. And this is what the left wants you to think. One of Alinsky's rules is always make yourself seem bigger than what you really are. So let's take a look at some of the things that we've seen that have happened in school where you've had strippers. Gay men that come in, they're transvestites, they've dressed up as a woman, and then they're going to do some kind of a strip show and do it for children. And so, first of all, is when you're looking at this kind of thing, realize and know that if it's true that gays are constitute about 1% of the population, then gay strippers, gay transvestite strippers are going to make up what percentage of the population? Even less. What, 1/100th, 1/1000th, first of all. So, and again, they want to make sure, the left does, that all this type of stuff gets on TV so that they can give people the illusion that this is some kind of a movement and it's something to be concerned with, to take seriously, and to be afraid of. And I think that if you stop and think about it, you're going to realize that it doesn't require the level of fear and hysteria that it's been treated with by talk show hosts. So you have that. The other thing you got to remember is that all of the children in these that are participating, their parents approved of this. Their parents were let know about this ahead of time, and their parents approved of it. And we know that because that's the way it works with schools. When schools are going to have special, if they're going to take the kids out to the museum or something like that, so it's a field trip or any kind of special events, they send a note home with the kids, and the parents have to sign off. The parents have to sign on there and say, yes, it's okay for Timmy to attend. So remember that. These are not children that are being victimized. It's not like all of a sudden one day all of the kids were rounded up, taken to the to some public spot or like, I don't know, the gym or something like that where they have this particular event and they have the stripper going on. No, this is the willing, the parents that are willing to go along with this. Okay, so that means that because you may be afraid, oh my God, what if this comes to my school, right? If it comes to your school and your son or child comes home, son or daughter comes home with a note, can Timmy participate in this? And you think it doesn't sound quite right because they probably won't tell you it's a stripper. Hey, we're planning to have a gay stripper show up to entertain the kids on Friday. Is it okay for your child to attend? They're probably not going to put it that way. They're going to put it in some other type of language. But anyways, the point is, you say no. You got to be a little bit alert, you know, look for it. Ask your child too every day when they come home. Are they doing any planning for any kind of events, special events? And on those days, you keep your child home. And when they bring home the permission slip, you simply say no. Sign it, date it, no, Timmy will not be attending. And that's the way you deal with that. We don't have to go out and get laws. The more laws that we get, the more we overreact to the situation, the worse that we make our government. Because we end up with a government that is going to be like a command and control. We cannot be call ourselves conservatives, and every time we have a problem, we run to the government for a solution. We run to Ron DeSantis. Please, please save us. From whom? Save us from ourselves? Say no. No, my child will not be attending. You can go further. You can also say that you will, or make it your policy not to have anything to do with parents whose children are allowed to attend this kind of a function because they're irresponsible. So, again, that's, for your judgment, but it's something to consider. So, again, don't be intimidated. They want fear. They want you to be intimidated. They want you to overreact. In any which way that you decide to overreact, it's to their benefit. They're hoping for violence. That's what they're really hoping for. They're looking to provoke normal people into running out into the street with pitchforks and torches and starting the next revolution for them. But it's not going to happen. And again, don't overreact. Assess the situation and act appropriately. Back in a minute.
I can never leave the past behind.
This is Ron, your host, the only true conservative in the United States today, bidding adios to all the butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers out there. So I'm reminding you that the left has no authority, no power, and they can't win.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.